Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Happening now, President Biden says he and Prime Minister Boris Johnson affirmed the special relationship between the U.S. and Britain during talks also aimed at smoothing over their differences. Bipartisan Senate negotiators now say they have struck a deal on infrastructure spending, but many of their colleagues remain skeptical it will ultimately be a success. And FDA advisors hold a sometimes very heated debate about authorizing COVID-19 vaccines for children under 12. One of those advisors will join us live and take us inside the deliberations. We want to welcome our viewers here in the United States and around the world. I'm Wolf Blitzer. You're in the Situation Room. Let's go straight to our senior White House correspondent, Phil Mattingly. He's in England for us right now. Phil, President Biden has wrapped up the first full day of his first overseas trip. So tell our viewers, what did he accomplish?
That meeting today was focused on the relationship between the U.S. and the United Kingdom. Obviously, there are political and personal differences that have been made very clear between President Biden and UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson, but those were nowhere to be seen, at least not publicly throughout the day, as the two leaders focused on strengthening the historic ties between their two nations. Tonight, President Biden starting off a week of critical meetings with foreign leaders with an effort to reinvigorate the special relationship.
This is to be British. I've been to my great country many times, but this is the first time as President of the United States.
Well, everybody's absolutely thrilled to see you.
Biden sitting down with British Prime Minister Boris Johnson, a carefully choreographed first overseas meeting, devoid of the tension behind the scenes over a handful of issues, most notably Brexit and the position of Northern Ireland.
We discharged and discuss the broad range of issues on which the United Kingdom and the United States are working in very close cooperation. We affirmed the special relationship.
Instead, a meeting framed with deliberate symbolism, the two leaders viewing the original copy of the Atlantic Charter, signed in 1941 by U.S. President Franklin Delano Roosevelt and British Prime Minister Winston Churchill amid the rise of fascism across the world.
With a revitalized Atlantic Charter, updated to reaffirm that promise while speaking directly to the key challenges of this century.
As he and Johnson signed an updated version of that declaration, the latest piece of an overarching effort by Biden to present a unified and reinvigorated alliance of Western democracies, one that will be challenged in just a matter of days as Biden sits down with Russian President Vladimir Putin and Biden's closest advisor, his wife Jill, telling reporters he's up for the challenge.
Oh my gosh, he's over-prepared.
The days ahead, a calibrated effort to lead the post-World War II Western alliances to meet the challenges of a new era.
America will be the arsenal of vaccines in our fight against COVID-19, just as America was the arsenal of democracy during World War II.
With a new vaccine effort at the center of that push. Biden announcing the purchase of 500 million doses of the Pfizer vaccine to be donated to 92 low- and middle-income countries and the African Union.
America will be the arsenal of vaccines in our fight against COVID-19, just as America was the arsenal of democracy during World War II.
Those first doses scheduled to ship out in August. And Wolf, President Biden making clear that the U.S. is not acting in isolation here. There is an expectation that when G7 leaders meet tomorrow, the other countries in that group will also pledge donations as well, really trying the U.S. trying to serve a leadership role as the president and allies leverage what they have in their large market economies to distribute those vaccine doses to countries of lower and middle income status, making clear they believe this would be a key component of both diplomacy and extremely important from a public health perspective, Wolf.
Certainly is, Art. Phil, stick around. We're going to get back to you in a few moments. But right now, I want to go to our chief international correspondent Clarissa Wirt. She's also in England covering this this summit. Clarissa, before becoming president, President Biden once called British Prime Minister Boris Johnson a physical and emotional clone of then President Trump. So how did the two men get along today?
Well, what a difference a couple of years makes, Wolf. We heard Prime Minister Boris Johnson call President Biden a breath of fresh air. And if before he was being compared to President Trump, now he's hoping he will be compared to Winston Churchill, who, of course, he admires greatly, has even written a book about. And he wants to sort of shift the narrative here, looking at the U.S. and the U.K. as two great global leaders working together in partnership, hearkening back to that relationship between Churchill and Roosevelt, and reshaping the global world in this time of great challenge. You heard them really try to strike a united front, jovial, jocular, often tone, and sometimes even deferential. Take a listen to this one exchange between them.
I told the Prime Minister we have something in common. We both married way above our station.
I'm not going to dissent from that one. I'm not going to disagree with the President there, or indeed on anything else. I think highly likely.
So you heard that there. I'm not going to disagree with anything he says. The emphasis here, not just from the UK, but from many people who President Biden will be meeting on in the run-up to this very important summit with President Putin, is that liberal democracies must stand together, and they must deliver, Wolf, a very concrete and firm message that the age of multilateralism is not over, that international cooperation is still relevant and important, and that the U.S. can still play a significant role in global leadership.
Yeah, well, these are really historic and very, very important talks that are going on. Clarissa, stay with us. I want to bring in right now the president of the Council on Foreign Relations, Richard Haass. He's also the author of the important book entitled The World, A Brief Introduction. There's the cover right there. So, Richard, give us the at times frosty relationship between these two men. How do you think the president handled this first crucial hour, this moment on his first major foreign trip with the British Prime Minister?
Well, the big news of the day was the change in U.S. vaccine export policy, and that was well received and welcome for all sorts of reasons. I think in terms of the relationship between the U.S. and the U.K., the U.K. needs the United States much more, in large part because of Brexit. One of the important rationales for this relationship was that the United States could have influence in Europe through the UK. That is now over. So the UK now needs the US more. The problem is the UK is somewhat less valuable to the United States, again, because of its separation from Europe. And also, given the Northern Ireland issue, it's not only the short-term differences there, Wolf, but also the potential for Scotland and Northern Ireland to threaten the integrity of the UK itself.
Yeah, that's obviously really, really important. President Biden, Richard, he clearly wants to signal a clean break with the Trump era, but there are still some serious issues on which the U.S. and its European allies clearly don't see eye to eye, right?
Oh, absolutely. They don't see eye to eye on how to deal with Russia. They don't see eye to eye on how to deal with China. There has been the vaccine issue. A lot of Europeans look at American society, issues like guns, and they shake their heads. They don't recognize that America issues over race. So there's enormous issues, and I have even brought up trade and other things. That said, let's be fair. This president has made the strategic decision, Wolf, that he is going to approach the world not unilaterally, as the previous administration so often did, but from a foundation of America's relationship with its principal allies in Europe and Asia. And that's one of the big differences between the two administrations.
Yeah, it's a huge difference indeed. In some ways, Richard, this trip, we could say, is decades in the making. President Biden obviously was deeply involved in foreign policy as a senator for some 36 years, as vice president for 8 years. Are we seeing that right now on display?
Oh, absolutely. All those times you would go with John McCain to the Munich Security Conference, he's comfortable. In the same way that he was comfortable in the Senate, talking to Republicans and Democrats alike. He's comfortable going overseas and talking to foreigners. He also is a great believer in personal diplomacy. Often American presidents exaggerate how important the personal element is. If he does, he wouldn't be the first to do so.
You know, Clarissa, these key U.S. alliances, they're about to be put to the test when President Biden actually sits down next Wednesday in Geneva with Russian President Putin. It's going to be a major test how it unfolds, right?
Of course, and that's why everybody's paying such close attention. And everybody really, I think, is asking the question as well, what is actually achievable here? What does success actually look like? There are so many different competing interests from the various democracies that kind of have a hand in this, that have great concerns about Russia's behavior on the world stage. And at the same time, there's very clear limitations as to what President Biden will be able to achieve by sitting down with President Putin. He's not going to simply say to him, you can't be cracking down on the opposition in the form of Navalny and expect President Putin to stop doing that. So the question becomes, what does success look like out of this? What are people expecting and hoping, and how can that be delivered?
And we will find out in the coming days. All right, guys, thank you very, very much. There's more breaking news coming into the Situation Room right now. New hope for an infrastructure deal as a group of Democratic and Republican senators announced they have reached a new plan. They've agreed on a new plan. Plus, new developments in the police shooting of Andrew Brown Jr., what state autopsy results are confirming about the case.
The Situation Room with Wolf Blitzer, brought to you by Cosentyx Secukinumab. See how real patients are finding real results at Cosentyx.com.
The breaking news right now, a bipartisan group of 10 senators, 5 Democrats, 5 Republicans, they have just announced they've reached an agreement on an infrastructure spending plan days after White House talks with Senate Republicans broke down. Let's go to our congressional correspondent, Ryan Nobles. He's up on the Hill working the story for us. So, Ryan, tell us what's going on.
Well, this is significant, Wolf. This bipartisan group of Republicans and Democrats, 10 in total, have been working behind closed doors on this infrastructure package. And they just announced in the last few minutes that they have struck a deal. And we are learning exactly how much money they plan to spend on infrastructure if they can get this proposal passed through the United States Senate and House. According to sources who are familiar with this deal, they're telling us that this deal is focused on core physical infrastructure. This, of course, that a big part of the debate right now on Capitol Hill, exactly how do you spend this money? They are going to plan to do this without any tax hikes. They're going to propose $579 billion in new spending. Added to that, they're going to repurpose even more money and the total cost of $1.2 trillion over 8 years. Now, this is a significant step, Wolf, the fact that we do have Republicans and Democrats agreeing on a proposal, but it still has a long way to go. Already, many Democrats are expressing concerns about these negotiations, this deal far short of what many had hoped and what the Biden administration had hoped for, and also the fact that they're planning to put this proposal forward without any kind of significant tax increase also has many Democrats concerned. In fact, there were Democrats telling our reporters today that they should just walk away from these talks and move on. But there is some optimism from leadership here in the Senate. The Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell saying he's open to seeing what these negotiators could come forward with. Well, if they still have a long way to go. It still requires 60 votes to get something passed in the Senate. Right now, they only have 10 for sure. So this deal far from over.
Yeah, but those 10, as we keep pointing out, 5 Democrats, 5 Republicans, that's pretty significant. Ryan, thank you very much. I want to get some more on these developments. CNN political analyst Maggie Haberman is joining us. She's the Washington correspondent for The New York Times. Also with us, our senior political correspondent, Abby Phillip. Abby, is this potentially the breakthrough a lot of folks have been waiting for?
Well, we'll see. I think this is the closest that we've gotten to actually seeing what more than one Republican might be willing to agree to in terms of a bipartisan deal. Now, there are a couple of roadblocks yet ahead, potentially. How will this fare in the House of Representatives, where already progressives are saying these talks are pushing the bill too small, taking out some important priorities like climate change and other things, and they are very skeptical of what might come out of this. And then secondly, even in the Senate, will Mitch McConnell allow his members to go ahead and vote for something, even if it's bipartisan? I think there's a strong political desire among Republicans to just say no to pretty much everything that the Biden administration wants.
Yeah, well, at least 5 Republicans are on board. This deal, you know, Maggie, just minutes before the deal was announced, some Democrats were saying it was time, Zebby points out, to pull the plug on these negotiations. Does this announcement, from your perspective, really change what's going on?
Look, Wolf, it certainly is a step, and from the White House's perspective, I think what they have wanted is all along to keep things moving, and they have talked about how there are multiple paths. Whether, as Abby says, that's realistic for this version to go through, I think remains to be seen. But there is this concern among some Democrats that the focus on this bill in particular, given the roadblocks that it's facing, is coming at the expense of other priorities, most notably a Voting Rights Act bill. There are Democrats who would like the Biden White House to be more vocal about getting involved. We know there's an announcement coming from the Justice Department tomorrow on voting rights, but what that looks like remains to be seen. And so I think that that is an area where you are going to hear increasing concern, or at least an increasing level of concern, among some of Biden's fellow members within the Congress.
You know, yesterday, Abby, when the Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg from the Biden administration was here, he seemed to agree with me that we can't let the perfect be the enemy of the good. Now, this may not be a perfect deal from a lot of Democrats' perspective, and certainly from a lot of Republicans' perspective, but a lot of them might conclude it's a good deal.
Yeah, I mean, that ought to be the mantra in Washington, but often it's not. It will be interesting to see whether the White House will be willing to really play ball on this deal. I mean, this is really the closest that they've gotten to really getting something from Republicans that Democrats may also be willing to agree to. And it's going to be hard for them to just walk away and say, this isn't good enough for us. This number of new spending that Ryan just described, that's an important factor here. How much new spending is there?
$578 billion,
which is significantly more than the previous negotiations was going to be. But it's still less than Biden wanted. Still, it's somewhere in the middle. And I think that that's going to be important for this White House. I think it will be hard for them to just walk away from this. But this may not be the final version. I think we may have some more iterations of this to go before we may even get to a vote.
It's still a negotiation. You know, Maggie, we're still in the process of what's going on. How much of this, from President Biden's perspective, is just about some optics, do you think, to simply be able to say he did everything he possibly could to get a bipartisan deal? He clearly, given his years in the Senate, would like a bipartisan deal.
Yeah, no, I think that there is sincerity when Biden says that he would like a bipartisan deal. I think that has been his approach the whole time. I also think that there is concern about something that Abby addressed before, which is the question of whether Republicans are going to try to stymie any legislative priority that the president might have. And that's an understandable question, just given that there was certainly that level of opposition when Biden was vice president under President Obama, and now when President Biden is in the White House. But I think that they are prepared, or at least they're signaling they're prepared, to potentially do this bill in other ways, such as reconciliation, such as breaking it up into two bills. I think, as Abby says, we are a ways away from what a final product could look like. But even this agreement from this group is something of progress, just given how little comity there has been between the two parties in Congress for a long time.
Yeah, at least it's moving in the right direction. All right, guys, thank you very, very much. Coming up, will COVID-19 vaccines be authorized for younger children by the end of the year? I'll talk to an FDA vaccine advisor who was inside today's rather intense debate. And new information emerging right now about the gunman behind the San Jose massacre offers up more evidence that authorities missed very significant warning signs. Stay with us. You're in the Situation Room. Tonight, FDA vaccine advisors have wrapped up a sometimes very contentious discussion about what it will take to green light COVID shots for children under 12. CNN national correspondent Erica Hill has our pandemic report.
A focus on children as an FDA advisory panel decides what should be considered before authorizing the COVID vaccine for kids 11 and younger.
What they are talking about today is the nitty-gritty, the logistics and practicalities of doing clinical trials in children as young as 5 or even as young as 6 months of age.
Among the committee, some disagreement on the urgency for these trials as infection rates drop.
The burden of disease is so small and the risks are just not clear.
We don't know what's going to happen. I think that's precisely the reason why we want to have these in our arsenal.
Moderna just filed for emergency use authorization of its vaccine for 12 to 17-year-olds. Pfizer's EUA was expanded for 12 to 15-year-olds late last month. About a quarter of that age group has now had at least one shot.
If everybody else gets vaccinated, percentage-wise, children are going to be the most susceptible section of our population to get COVID. So we need to protect them first and foremost.
More than half the residents in these eight states are now fully vaccinated. Nationwide, it's just over 42%.
We knew it was going to get harder as this effort went on. But one thing that we have learned more clearly than anything else is that this vaccination effort will move at the speed of trust.
Trust with a dose of incentive.
Mark, you won the $1 million. How you guys doing?
It was pretty surreal. You know, from the moment we looked out and we saw you on our doorstep.
If cash isn't enough to encourage more Americans to roll up their sleeves, officials hope their warnings about the fast-spreading Delta variant may do the trick.
This variant is even more transmissible than the UK variant, which was more transmissible than the version of the virus we were dealing with last year. And there's also some concern that it may be more dangerous as well.
Good news for J&J's single-dose vaccine. The FDA just said it can be stored for 4.5 months. That's 6 weeks longer than previously allowed. The news comes days after Ohio warned some 200,000 J&J shots would soon expire. And Wolf, just one other note on that Johnson & Johnson vaccine. A member of J&J's board, former FDA Commissioner Dr. Mark McClellan, telling CNN earlier today that one of the reasons they just don't know how long this vaccine can be stored is because, frankly, everything's happened so quickly as part of this emergency. But he did say, Wolf, that those studies are ongoing.
Erica Hill in New York for us. Thank you very much. Let's discuss all of this with a key member of the FDA's Vaccine Advisory Committee who was in today's meeting. Dr. Paul Offit is also the director of the Vaccine Education Center at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. Dr. Offit, thanks so much for joining us. So take us inside the deliberations today. Are you confident that American children under the age of 12 will be able to get the COVID vaccine by the end of the year?
I'm confident that there was unanimity among the advisors that it's important to have a vaccine for children. I'm confident that we all agreed that there are probably going to be differences in terms of how we view the 6 to 12-year-old versus the 2 to 6-year-old versus the 6-month to 2-year-old in terms of what we want from each of those categories in terms of whether we want it to be through an emergency use authorization or licensure, how many thousands of children need to be studied in each of those groups, how much work do we need to have in terms of dose ranging studies, et cetera. I'm not sure. I certainly think we would have a vaccine by early next year, and hopefully we'll have a vaccine for the 6 to 12 year old by the end of the year.
One expert in the meeting, Dr. Mark Sawyer, said we need the vaccines for kids, in his words, sooner rather than later. First of all, do you agree with that?
I do. I mean, children certainly suffer and are hospitalized and occasionally die from this virus. I mean, there's been about 4 million children who've been infected. About 550,000 are between 0 and 4 years of age. You've had almost 40,000 hospitalizations. You've had thousands of children who've had to suffer this disease called multi-system inflammatory disease, which is frightening, frankly. And about 300 children have died. So this is a virus that can cause children to suffer, be hospitalized, and die. And for that reason, I think children do need to be protected. Now, if we're past the pandemic, if this is all behind us, then that's not going to be an issue. But we're not past the pandemic. I mean, the variants are still out there and becoming more contagious. I think when the winter comes, you're going to see this virus surge again. So we still need a vaccine. Frankly, as long as this virus still exists in the world, and it does, there's 195 countries out there, many of which have never given a single dose of vaccine. As long as this virus exists in this world, we're going to need to have a population that is highly immune.
Yeah, I just checked before the show with Johns Hopkins University. The 7-day average of deaths here in the United States, the last 7-day daily deaths, 410. The 7-day average of cases now 14,932. So there's still a lot of Americans suffering from this, even though we've made tremendous progress with these vaccines. Officials are sounding the alarm over the rise of the so-called Delta variant, which is apparently much more contagious. What does the U.S. need to do right now, Dr. Offit, to prepare for the possibility of this new variant actually becoming the dominant strain here in the U.S.?
Right, so this is the third variant, right? The first virus that came into our country was a variant. Then came the so-called UK variant or the Alpha variant. Now we have this variant that was first detected in India, the so-called Delta variant. The virus keeps mutating so that it gets more contagious. As long as that's true, then you need to have a higher and higher percentage of the population that's immune. And when we're not there yet, I mean, you're seeing even in the summer, when this is basically a winter respiratory virus, you're still seeing tens of thousands of cases and still seeing hundreds of deaths. We need to get this population vaccinated as high as possible, as fast as possible, to stop the creation of these variants.
We've made tremendous progress, but this battle is by no means yet over. Dr. Offit, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Just ahead, new information about the San Jose gunman who killed 9 co-workers. Possible missed signals about the threat he posed. New developments tonight of the police shooting death of Andrew Brown Jr., a state autopsy confirming he died from a gunshot to the back of his head. CNN's Brian Todd is working the story for us, and we want to warn our viewers that some of the video you're about to see is graphic.
Tonight, a new autopsy report from the North Carolina Medical Examiner's Office confirms what Andrew Brown Jr.'s family and their attorneys have asserted for weeks, that Brown died of a gunshot wound to the back of the head when sheriff's deputies trying to arrest him fired on his car in Elizabeth City, North Carolina on April 21st. The manner of death, according to the new report, homicide. It also says Brown suffered a non-fatal gunshot wound and other wounds to his right arm. Tonight, one piece of crucial information has still not been made public. Which of the 3 deputies who discharged their weapons fired the fatal shot?
I think the issue still, the investigation is going to have to show, you know, where that shot came from, if they can determine what the threat was at that moment of the shot.
The district attorney's office does not dispute that Brown died of a gunshot wound to the back of the head. What is in dispute? Whether Brown was simply trying to get away and tried to avoid the deputies, as his family says.
He got executed. It ain't right.
Or if he was using his car as a weapon, as DA Andrew Womble claims.
Mr. Brown's actions caused 3 deputies with the Pasquotank County Sheriff's Office to reasonably believe it was necessary to use deadly force to protect themselves and others.
On the deputy's body camera video, officers are seen surrounding Brown in his car. He backs the car up. Deputies scramble. Then he moves forward, turning toward the left. Deputies open fire, and the car speeds away. The DA elected not to prosecute any deputies, leading to questions about his objectivity.
You cannot have the local district attorney who's evaluating and investigating cases prosecuting police that they rely upon to bring about successful prosecutions for them in their own local jurisdiction. It doesn't work.
2 Brown family attorneys tell CNN tonight that by the end of this month, the family plans to file a federal civil rights lawsuit regarding Andrew Brown Jr.'s death against multiple jurisdictions and the individual officers involved. In a statement today, the family attorneys accused DA Andrew Womble of trying to hide the facts in this case, of showing, quote, cowardice and deceit. Womble's office has not responded to CNN's requests for comment. Wolf.
All right, Brian, thank you. Brian Todd reporting. Let's get some more on all of this. Harry Daniels is joining us. He's an attorney for the Andrew Brown Jr. family. Harry, thanks very much for joining us. What else can you tell us about lawsuit you're planning to file?
Well, we plan on bringing the suit very soon. We're in the process of putting it together. So it's coming real soon. Don't have the exact date, but it's coming real soon. And the lawsuit's going to speak for itself. I think that is crystal clear on the video that have been shown at this point that this was an unjustified killing of Andrew Brown. There's no way you can get around it. All expert analysts across the nation have determined this was not justified. The only person who reason believe is justified is the district attorney, and his objectivity is not there because he, like you said, he works with the officers every day who's accused or involved in the shooting with Andrew Brown.
How much do the results of this autopsy bolster your argument, Harry, that the officers involved in the killing should be prosecuted?
Well, one thing I want to point to the autopsy is that there, in the report, there's no stippling or gunpowder residue around the entry wound of Andrew Brown's head. That's a clear indication that that bullet was shot from a distance and a high caliber weapon. They discharged almost 13 to 14 shots at Mr. Brown Our independent autopsy determined that it was bullet wounds to the arm, as well as a gunshot wound to the back of the head. There's nobody have never said the wound did not, the wound that the fatal wound was not in the back of the head, but it's a concrete confirmation. That's definitely coming from the state of North Carolina autopsy that Mr. Brown was killed while he was trying to flee and get away.
There are still several unanswered questions, and I know you're working it very, very closely. We'll stay in close touch with you. Harry Daniels, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Will. Thanks for having me.
Coming up, we're learning the gunman behind the San Jose mass shooting was disciplined at work multiple times before he killed nine co-workers. Plus, a remarkably thinner Kim Jong-un and the potential national security implications of his significant weight loss. We'll update you on that as well. New information tonight about the gunman who killed nine co-workers at a San Jose rail yard before taking his own life last month. CNN's Dan Simon is joining us right now. Dan, so what are you learning about the number of times he was disciplined at work before the shooting?
Well, hi, Wolf. There were four incidents, and these will surely raise additional questions whether or not this shooting could have been prevented. Let's go to July 2019. The shooter, Sam Cassidy, suspended for 2 days without pay for insubordination. But the one that is certain to raise eyebrows occurring in January 2020, there was some kind of altercation with a fellow employee. That employee went to management and quoted another coworker who reportedly said if someone was to go postal, it would be him. But the VTA said today there was nothing in Cassidy's disciplinary history or any additional information to support that particular allegation. There were two other incidents, Wolf, one involving misusing a radio, the other the shooter's failure to get CPR certification. Nothing that hinted at any potential violence, but the VTA says it still has thousands of documents to go through. The bottom line here, this is somebody who had a contentious relationship with his employer, and as we know from previous reporting, he was somebody who was highly disgruntled.
Yeah, there were signs out there. All right, Dan Simon, thank you very much. Also tonight, new questions right now about the health of the North Korean strongman Kim Jong-un after what appears to be a rather significant weight loss. CNN's Will Ripley has our report.
Time may not be the only thing Kim Jong-un's watch is good at telling. Can it also be a barometer for the North Korean leader's level of fitness? Kim is often pictured wearing the same $12,000 IWC Swiss timepiece, believed to be one of his favorites. Images released Saturday by North Korean state media and analyzed by South Korean media appear to show the watch fitting on a much tighter notch than in previous sightings, indicating a thinner wrist and sparking widespread speculation about a weight loss transformation. Side-by-side video comparisons do appear to show Kim to be much more svelte now than in 2020. But far from just being an internet curiosity, Kim's suddenly slimmer appearance could have geopolitical implications. His weight is one of many things global intelligence agencies monitor.
Why would spy agencies in South Korea and the U.S. be looking at something like Kim Jong-un's weight?
His health is obviously a concern of foreign governments in the region because the country has nuclear weapons. It's a dictatorship with the cult of personality leadership system. So if something happens to the leader, that affects regional security.
Experts have long assessed that Kim Jong-un was at high risk of cardiovascular disease. His family also has a history of heart issues. Kim's father and grandfather both died of heart attacks while head of North Korea. In November 2020, the National Intelligence Service of South Korea reportedly told lawmakers they believed Kim Jong-un's weight had ballooned to about 308 pounds, speculating that he had gained some 108 pounds since coming to power in 2011. In recent months, the already reclusive Kim has been out of the public eye more than usual amidst rumors of declining health. His reappearance Saturday on the global stage, arguably reigniting that conversation among foreign intelligence agencies. Could the sudden shedding of pounds be the result of some mysterious illness? Or is he thinner by choice, a conscious effort to achieve better health and extend his longevity as leader? The answer? Only time will tell.
The fact that we are even talking about Kim Jong-un's watch strap, Wolf, just shows how secretive North Korea is when it comes to the health of Kim Jong-un. This is the leader who famously brought his own toilet to summit meetings with the former president, Donald Trump, so that foreign governments couldn't sneak a DNA sample.
Excellent reporting. Will Ripley in Taipei, thank you very, very much. Coming up, we're going to speak to the legendary coach, Mike Krzyzewski. There he is. He's standing by live. Duke University, he's retiring after 40 years. We'll discuss a special interview when we come back. Finally tonight, we're joined by one of the greatest college basketball coaches of all time, the legendary Mike Krzyzewski of Duke University. There you see him. He recently announced plans to retire after an epic 40-plus years of coaching and winning. Coach Krzyzewski, thanks so much for joining us. I'm a huge fan, as you know. Why did you decide now was the time to finally announce your retirement?
Well, it's going to be 47 years at the end of this year. I'll be 75. My wife is 75. And it's time to enjoy our 10 grandchildren. And by the way, it's been a dream of mine to get into the darn situation room. I finally got, I'm proud of that.
Well, we're thrilled that you're joining us here in the Situation Room because you're simply amazing. Let's talk a little bit about your fabulous career. Looking back, what do you consider to be the greatest moment of your coaching career?
Well, it's representing the United States on the world stage. Again, not to put down our five national championships, but there's nothing like winning the Olympics or the world championship and seeing our flag raised above the others and the national anthem being played and our guys with their hands over their hearts. You got to be kidding me. As a West Pointer, there could not be a finer moment than that.
Yeah, it's an amazing moment indeed. And you were the head coach of the USA basketball team at the Olympics, and what, until 2016. College basketball, let's talk a little bit about college basketball. I love basketball. It's changed a lot since you started coaching, what, 47 years ago. Some people say it needs a radical overhaul right now, that it's time to start paying the players. What do you think?
Well, it does need an overhaul. There's no question. And it's a result of not doing overhauls along the way. And now there's a major one. And with NIL coming into play, transfers and all that, it really needs really centralized leadership. Because at the end of the day, men's college basketball is a billion-dollar business, and it has to be run a little bit more like a business.
You think it's going to change?
Yeah, it has to. Hopefully we're going to get some help from Congress in the next couple of weeks to make sure that the name, image, and likeness will be the same around the country, because right now it's not. And this is a big summer for college sports, and especially for men's college basketball.
It certainly is. And let me, while I have you, Coach, let me get your thoughts on the upcoming Tokyo Olympic Games. As we noted, you coached Team USA men's basketball until 2016. If you were still coaching now, would you think it's a good idea to travel to Tokyo for the Olympic Games during the middle of this pandemic?
Well, I would really follow, like I always do, the advice of our medical people. If they said it was right, then I trust them. And we would not want to put any of the players in harm's way. So they'll do that in a very diligent way. And then I would follow the advice. As a leader, you want to pay attention to the smart people that you have around you. And certainly our medical people are some of the smartest in the world.
So if they said go, you would go? Is that what I'm hearing?
Yeah, absolutely. And I know Greg Popovich, a good friend, one of the great coaches of all time. He'll have our team ready, along with Jerry Colangelo, who's running the men's program right now.
And you have one more year of coaching before you hang it up, right? So give us a sense. How is that going to be?
Exciting. I'm happy. I got a great group of young men. Our freshmen are here in summer school. For me, I'm always, right now I'm 55 years older than the kids I coach. How many 74-year-old guys have an opportunity to be be with young kids who are ambitious and striving to be their best. It's been a joy.
It certainly has been, and it's been a joy watching you over these years as well. Thank you. Thank you so much for all you have done. We'll stay in close touch. And to our viewers, thanks very much for watching. Aaron Burnett on Front starts right now.
When you work next level. When you play next level. And when it's time to sleep, Sleep Number smart beds are designed to embrace your uniqueness, providing you with high-quality sleep every night. Sleep next level. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, the Queen Sleep Number C4 smart bed is only $1,599. Save $300 for a limited time, only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com. Prices higher in Alaska and Hawaii. Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number smart bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.